As a warning, this episode includes descriptions of violent acts. Please be advised.
It's May 14th, 1970, a Thursday. Someone has stolen a dump truck and set it on fire in the middle of John R. Lynch Street in Jackson, Mississippi. You'd be forgiven for assuming Lynch Street was named for lynching. In fact, its namesake is John Ray Lynch, an emancipated slave and Mississippi's first black congressman.
West Jackson was essentially a white suburb, and Jackson State sat between West Jackson and downtown.
Still, the street has been a point of contention for most of the 1960s. Robert Luckett is a civil rights historian at Jackson State University.
So these white suburban folks who are living in West Jackson would drive through the Jackson State campus on this street, this thoroughfare, to get downtown and get to their jobs, which made it a point of conflict with Jackson State students. We are a historically black college, right? White motorists were known for shouting racist epithets, throwing things out their windows, and in 1964, they hit a young Jackson State student named Mamie Ballard.
Since at least 1964, students had been pushing the city to close a portion of the street on campus so they could have a safe place to walk.
And you can imagine by 1970, again, as the civil rights movement is evolving more into the Black Power movement, the tenor of the protests become more vocal, more vociferous. They were not violent, and I want to stress that. They were not violent protests, but they weren't nonviolent direct action either. These weren't pacifists who were making these demands. These are fully informed young adults saying, we demand this street to be closed. So there had been a series of pretty intense protests leading up to that night.
Back to the dump truck. The fire department responds and puts out the blaze. Students continue to gather at the site, protesting for the closure of Lynch Street. Hours later, most of the students are gone when the Jackson Police and State Highway Patrol show up.
They're in full riot gear. They're accompanied by what's called the Thompson Tank, which was a fully armored personnel carrier that the segregationist mayor of Jackson, Allen Thompson, had purchased ahead of Freedom Summer in 1964 when he called the invasion of activists that were coming that summer.
The National Guard rings the campus, but hang back while the police and highway patrol start marching towards Alexander Hall, a woman's dormitory. It's almost midnight, and a small group of students is hanging out. Multiple eyewitness reports say one of the students threw a bottle at the officers.
You know, you can imagine these young people, they're hanging out in front of a women's dorm, they're flirting, they're, you know, listening to music, they're hanging out. So they see these cops come up and they're in riot gear. Like, what are y'all doing? And you can imagine a student just chunking something at them.
The police later claim there was a sniper in the women's dorm and that they had to respond. In less than 30 seconds, they fire more than 500 rounds into the group of students and at the dormitory. 12 students were shot. Dozens more were injured in the chaos as they ran for cover and were hit by shattering bricks and glass. 2 students died. One was a high school senior named James Earl Green, who was walking home from work. The other was Jackson State political science major, Philip Gibbs. He was married and had a young child. Unbeknownst to him at the time, his wife was pregnant with their second child. Robert Luckett says when the firing was done, the officers bent down, picked up their shell casings, and left.
No one was ever charged with a crime that night. The family sued the city and the state in a civil lawsuit that they lost.
This is the Mississippi Freedom Trail podcast, a series where historians and experts help us explore some of the most significant events of the state's civil rights movement. You'll also hear the real stories of people who were there and who made a difference, and why what took place then is still so relevant to us today. Long before the shooting on Jackson State campus, civil rights leaders in Mississippi started laying the strategy for how to fundamentally change the state's universities, its public services, and private business. Clyde Kinnard was one of the pioneers. He was born in Hattiesburg in 1927, but grew up in what was known as the Kelly Settlement. It was a small community just north of Hattiesburg in Forest County, named after Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general, and the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
When people think of segregation, they certainly think of Mississippi, and they think of, you know, the 50s and even earlier, their minds may go immediately to the worst of the scenario, the most drastic cases of racism and racial prejudice.
Sherita Johnson is director for the Center for Black Studies at the University of Southern Mississippi. She says Kelly Settlement was different from many other places in the state. For one, from the late 1800s onward, interracial relationships were largely tolerated. Many families were mixed. Kennard's wasn't, but he would have grown up seeing it somewhat normalized. And that's just the beginning, says Cheryl Jenkins, associate director of the Center for Black Studies.
There in that community, people there were entrepreneurs, most people were educated, that there was something very special and unique about the Kelly Settlement community and the people in that community that I think probably gave him the drive and the thought that I could really pursue an education in the Deep South during this period of heavy segregation.
After high school, Kennard enlisted in the Army. He served in World War II and then in Korea as a paratrooper. After leaving the Army, he enrolled at the University of Chicago, but left after his junior year to go back to Mississippi to help his mother run the family farm. In the early 1950s, roughly 45% of Mississippi's population was African American. But of that black population that was eligible to vote, less than 6% were registered. Most were afraid to register because they worked as sharecroppers or day laborers at white-owned plantations or other businesses. There are countless examples of white business owners firing black employees who tried to register to vote. It was an economic hammer they could wield. But Kennard, who'd been able to vote when he was in the military, had a level of economic independence with his family farm. That, plus his military experience and 3 years at the University of Chicago, gave him the confidence to try and enroll at what was then Mississippi Southern College, and now the University of Southern Mississippi.
In 1955, we're just a year outside of Brown versus Board of Education. From a media standpoint, which is where, you know, a lot of people learn, unfortunately, about the racial terrors from the newspapers at that time, or the images maybe in other forms of commentary, it's not as visible yet to those outside of the black community when Kennard attempts to register at Southern Miss. We don't have the integration of Ole Miss yet. We don't have a lot of things that would sort of trigger people to really understand the implications of Kennard attempting to enroll at this segregated institution.
William McCain was president of Mississippi Southern College. He was a segregationist and staunch supporter of the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, the state agency that covertly worked to suppress the efforts of civil rights activists. McCain pressured local black leaders and leveraged his contacts in the state political establishment to prevent Kennard from enrolling. The reason given? He didn't provide recommendations from 5 Southern Mississippi College alums from his county. But Kennard was undeterred. He applied again in 57, denied, and again in 59, also denied, and arrested. Minutes after trying to enroll, constables charge him with reckless driving and illegal liquor possession. Mississippi was a dry state. The constables testified before a judge that Kennard had whiskey and other liquor hiding under the seat of his car. Almost a year to the day of his first arrest, Kennard, a decorated soldier, devout Baptist, and farmer, was arrested again on charges of encouraging 19-year-old Johnny Lee Roberts to steal $25 worth of chicken feed from a local warehouse. Roberts testified against him in court. An all-white jury deliberated 10 minutes and found Kennard guilty. Medgar Evers called it a mockery of the justice system. Kennard was sentenced to 7 years at Mississippi's notorious Parchman Penitentiary.
To be sent directly to Parchman was in itself an extreme measure taken by the state to not just send a message to African Americans, but to totally shut down any idea about integrating the public school system. Parchman historically was, it becomes, I should say, this notorious prison camp, one of the worst in the state, if not the region, if not the nation, because it had a long standing history of abuse and exploitation of Black labor. Any crime that you want to name against humanity, Parchman was part of it.
Clyde Kennard would only serve 3 years of his sentence. He was diagnosed with advanced colon cancer, and the governor would suspend his sentence so he could return to Chicago for treatment. 2 surgeries and 6 months later, 36-year-old Clyde Kennard died, never having graduated from college. Decades later, newly unsealed documents from the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission confirmed that officials with the agency had considered forcing Kennard into a car accident or bombing his car to stop him from trying to enroll at Mississippi Southern. And in 2006, Johnny Lee Roberts recanted his story about the chicken feed. Clyde Kennard didn't get his dream, but another man picked up the mantle. James Meredith was born in 1933 to parents whose roots were African, English-Canadian, Scots, and Choctaw. After graduating high school, he served for 9 years in the U.S. Air Force, then attended Jackson State University for 2 years. But he wanted more. In 1961, inspired by President John F. Kennedy, he started applying to the University of Mississippi. Despite the ruling in Brown versus Board years earlier, the school was still all white. In his first attempt to break the color barrier, Meredith wrote that he was applying for his country, his race, his family, and himself. This is what he wrote, as read by an actor.
Nobody handpicked me. I believed and believe now that I have a divine responsibility. I am familiar with the probable difficulties involved in such a move as I am undertaking, and I am fully prepared to pursue it all the way to a degree from the University of Mississippi.
When the school twice denied him, Meredith sought help from the NAACP. They filed a lawsuit alleging that he was rejected only on the basis of race. The case went through many hearings. Eventually, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 5th District ruled that Meredith had the right to be admitted to the state school. The state appealed, and the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case.
The contempt with which they are charged caused rioting, loss of life, and the need for federal troops to uphold the law of the land on the campus of the University of Mississippi. We're not concerned here with the details of those tragic events, but a careful understanding of the incidents leading up to the entry of the order in question and to its violation is essential to understand both how the United States came to seek this order and also why it was entered by a court of appeals rather than a district court. For that reason, I want to take some little time carefully to state the sequence of events leading up to the order.
On September 10, 1962, the High Court ruled that the University of Mississippi must let James Meredith enroll. It set off a firestorm. Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett declared no school in the state will integrate while he's governor. The legislature passed a law that denied admission to anyone who has been convicted of a felony or has a crime of moral turpitude against him. That same day, Meredith was accused, tried, and convicted in absentia of false voter registration. Federal officials obtained an injunction against the enforcement of the Moral Turpitude Act and of 2 state court decrees that had barred Meredith's registration. That same day, university officials prepared to admit him, but Governor Barnett stepped in and forbade it. 8 days later, a court of appeals found the governor in civil contempt, ordered him arrested, and to pay a fine of $10,000 a day until he allowed Meredith to enroll. A day later, the court found the lieutenant governor in contempt and imposed a $5,000 a day fine. Over the next few days, Governor Barnett had a series of phone calls with U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy. They came to an agreement. Barnett would let Meredith enroll if Kennedy issued a proclamation that demanded it and sent in federal law enforcement. This allowed Barnett to save face. Robert Kennedy ordered more than 500 U.S. Marshals, Border Patrol, and Federal Bureau of Prison Officers to accompany Meredith during his arrival and registration. President John F. Kennedy issued a proclamation that he would use the armed forces to suppress any insurrection, domestic violence, or other attempts to keep Meredith from enrolling. Tensions were high. Despite promises to maintain law and order, Governor Barnett delivered a defiant speech at Saturday night's Ole Miss football game. Tens of thousands of fans cheer him on. September 30th, 1962 was a Sunday. By late afternoon, a group of Ole Miss students gathered outside the university administrative building, known as the Lyceum. Federal agents and an Army Engineer Combat Battalion out of Kentucky had set up headquarters inside. President Kennedy addressed the nation, saying he deeply regrets he has to federalize the state National Guard.
If this country should ever reach the point where any man or group of men, by force or threat of force, could long deny the commands of our court and our Constitution, then no law would stand free from doubt. No judge would be sure of his writ, and no citizen would be safe from his neighbors.
James Meredith was flown into Oxford, and two dozen federal marshals escorted him to a campus dormitory. Within an hour, a riot begins. Despite Governor Barnett's earlier agreement to assist federal forces, a state senator withdrew local police, and as they left, they dismantled all of the barriers around the campus. Thousands of outsiders entered. They threw Molotov cocktails and bottles of acid at U.S. Marshals, who were under order not to fire under any circumstances, except if James Meredith's life was in imminent danger. 4 hours after the riots start, Governor Barnett got on the radio and declared, "We will never surrender." Rioters burned cars and a mobile television unit. They shot at journalists and marshals. Military police and soldiers eventually showed up and started evacuating the wounded and arresting rioters. By the end of the 15-hour riot, two civilians were dead, a French journalist who was shot in the back, and a 23-year-old man shot execution style in the forehead. Hundreds more were wounded or injured in the melee. Historian William Doyle later told The Guardian, "It was a sheer miracle that scores, if not hundreds, of Americans were not slaughtered that night." The day after the riot, Governor Barnett called federal officials and offered to pay for Meredith to attend any college outside of Mississippi. The feds rejected the offer. On October 1, 1962, James Meredith became the first African-American student to enroll at a public school in Mississippi. It was a pivotal moment in the history of civil rights in the United States. Taking a pause here to say that if you're interested in following the Mississippi Freedom Trail through places like Holly Springs, Oxford, Jackson, Hattiesburg, Biloxi, and elsewhere in the state, go to visit Mississippi.org or civilrightstrail.com. It's a great way to begin planning your trip. Okay, back to the story. The desegregation of Mississippi schools and public places can be traced back to a strong tradition of activism on the campuses of historically black colleges and universities. The first desegregation victory of the 1960s was led by students from Tougaloo College. The college was built on the grounds of what was once one of the largest slave plantations in central Mississippi. In 1869, the American Missionary Association of New York purchased 500 acres to build what was known then as Tougaloo University for recently freed enslaved people and their children. You could say civil rights and social justice are embedded in Tougaloo's DNA. Nearly a century later, 9 Tougaloo students made history when they staged a read-in at the all-white Jackson Municipal Public Library.
And of course, what prompted them were these conversations around not having adequate reading materials at the local Black library or the local quote-unquote colored library.
Historian Daphne Chamberlain is Associate Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Tougaloo College.
And of course, the Jackson Municipal Public Library, those tax dollars that pay for that library and the materials therein were tax dollars that were being paid by Black folk here in the city of Jackson, just as well as the white citizens.
On March 27, 1960, the students walked into the library for Black residents and asked for books they knew the library didn't have. When they couldn't get the books, they went over to the main library, the one for whites, found the books, sat down, and began to read. They were told they needed to go back to the Black library. When they refused, library staff called the police. The students stood their ground and were arrested and charged with breach of peace for failing to follow police orders. The students each faced a $500 fine and 6 months of jail.
Word got out that the Tougaloo Nine had been arrested, and students at Jackson State College rallied around these young people.
Joyce and Dory Ladner, sisters who attended Jackson State, organized a prayer vigil. While Tougaloo was a private institution, Jackson State was public and subject to pressure to stay out of the civil rights movement. The school expelled the Ladner sisters.
They did turn around and enroll at Tougaloo College, where they completed their education and became some of the most high-profile women activists in the civil rights movement here in the state of Mississippi.
What happened in that moment, seeing the bravery of the Tougaloo Nine, as well as the Ladner sisters, was a turning point for student activism in Mississippi. The day after the Tougaloo Nine were arrested, Jackson State students boycotted classes and marched to the county jail, led by NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers. During their march, they were tear-gassed and attacked by police dogs. In protest, Jackson's Black community waged an Easter week boycott of white businesses that discriminated against Blacks. The results were mixed. Medgar Evers was quoted in the newspaper saying 70% of the Black community participated in the boycott, and one white store manager, whose business relied heavily on Black customers, reported a 30 to 50% dip in sales. But a UPI survey of merchants found that more than half of store clerks reported no slack in business. 9 months later, the NAACP filed a class action lawsuit against Jackson's public library, and in June of 1962, a federal judge ordered the library to desegregate. This was followed in May of 1963 by 3 Black Tougaloo students staging a sit-in at Jackson's Woolworth's lunch counter. They were joined by more students and professors, both Black and white. A white mob screamed at the protesters and poured hot coffee and condiments on them. Photos from the event were widely circulated. And 2 weeks later, Byron De La Beckwith assassinated Medgar Evers.
I have not met anyone who was active in the movement in the 1960s who did not revere Medgar Wiley Evers, and especially students here on the campus of Tougaloo College. They held him in high regard and continue to hold him in high regard because of how supportive he was. He gave them the autonomy to think. He gave them the autonomy to act. And he supported them in ways where they didn't feel supported by others in the Black community. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that he was just there and really gave them what they needed and allowed them to think, allowed them to strategize, allowed them to grow as activists, but also as leaders, even outside of the movement. So he really showed that he respected these young people and what they brought to the table to change things for Black folks here in the state of Mississippi. But of course, the night that he was assassinated, the shot rang out in that community, but it was just like that shot rang out across the state of Mississippi and across the nation.
All of this put a lot of pressure on the Kennedy administration. Eventually, they brokered an agreement between local African-American leaders and the mayor's office to promote a few Black city workers and hire a small number of Black police officers to patrol their own neighborhoods. In exchange, future protests were called off, but Jackson remained segregated until passage of the Civil Rights Act in July 1964. There were other active campuses in Mississippi. During the 1950s and 60s, thousands of mostly volunteer students from around the country traveled to Mississippi to help register African Americans to vote. They faced violence and death threats. In 1960, Leslie Burl McLemore was president of the freshman class of Mississippi's oldest historically Black college, Russ College in Holly Springs, about an hour southeast of Memphis and northwest of Jackson. One of his first actions was an attempt to integrate the town's movie theater.
Black folk, of course, were in the balcony, white folk were downstairs. And so that theater protest was my initial foray in the movement. There was one drugstore in town that had seats at the counter, and we tried to integrate it, but then they took the seats out of the drugstore.
Russ students then focused their attention on voter registration. In 1962, they started a campus chapter of the NAACP. Medgar Evers himself swore in McLemore as a chapter president. Also that year, Rust allowed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, to set up an office on campus to help organize the Black community in Holly Springs. It became a safe place for civil rights workers from all over to meet and organize.
When SNCC came to town, SNCC started an above-ground civil rights movement, right? Prior to that, it had been subterranean. I mean, it was dangerous to be a member of the NAACP and show your membership card. It was dangerous to organize above ground. So what we were doing in Holly Springs in 1960 had not been done before. Nobody had been going from door to door trying to get Black folk to register in 1960. In 61. No one had done that.
Down in the capital city, Jackson State University became home to the Council of Federated Organizations, or COFO. This coalition of major civil rights organizations, including SNCC, the NAACP, and the Congress of Racial Equality, has been described as the nerve center of the freedom movement. It was the brainchild of SNCC activist Bob Moses, who envisioned an umbrella group that would organize the work of all major civil rights groups in the state. Jackson State historian Robert Luckett says that was a feat because there were some pretty intense rivalries.
And in other states, these leaders butted heads with each other, right? The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King's organization, did not get along with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, in other places. Georgia, infamously, right? They would butt heads down in Albany, Georgia. And so, frankly, the more kind of vibrant leaders of these organizations were often more likely to be entangled or ensnared in kind of deep conflicts and rivalries. And some of that is, I would guess, relatively normal, especially for civil rights groups that are struggling to make a mark and to raise funds and to support the work they're doing. Bob Moses wasn't like that at all. Bob certainly was a vibrant leader, but if you ever met him, he was soft-spoken, pretty kind of shy, really, relatively quiet, deeply thoughtful and intellectual. And he didn't have, honestly, the type of ego that a lot of these great leaders might have.
Luckett says Moses also benefited from a very early endorsement of COFO from Medgar Evers. COFO did some direct action, but largely focused on voter registration, which was protected by federal law. COFO connected younger activists, teenagers, and college students to veteran leaders of the movement. It sponsored Freedom Summer with its schools, farms, cooperatives, and theaters.
And then the rise of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party as a political party that attempted at the Democratic National Convention that summer to unseat the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party.
One of the founding members of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was Aaron Henry. Born to sharecroppers, Henry served in the Army during World War II, then used the GI Bill to enroll in pharmacy school at Xavier University. He graduated in 1950 and opened a pharmacy in Clarksdale, Mississippi. He was active in voter registration efforts, and in 1959, he was elected president of the state chapter of the NAACP. In 1961, on the heels of Clarksdale's mayor banning the two black high schools from marching in the Christmas parade, which they'd done for more than a decade, Henry, Medgar Evers, and others staged a boycott. They were frustrated that white-owned stores refused to hire blacks for anything other than menial jobs. The boycott slogan was, "If we can't parade downtown, we won't trade downtown." It was economically devastating because more than two-thirds of the county's population was black, and white businesses relied on them. The boycott lasted 2 years. Henry and others were arrested and convicted of conspiring to withhold trade. His pharmacy was attacked, and his wife was fired from her job as a school teacher. When he died in 1997, the Washington Post and other major newspapers noted that over more than 30 years of fighting for racial justice, Henry was spat on, arrested, firebombed, and once chained to a garbage truck and led through the streets of Clarksdale to jail. 230 miles south of Clarksdale, Macomb, Mississippi had long been a site of violence. In 1911, there were deadly riots during a railroad strike. And then, throughout the middle part of the century, the KKK. In 1961, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee tried registering black voters, but faced physical attacks and intimidation from the Klan. SNCC called for a sit-in at the segregated Greyhound bus station. Two boys, high schoolers who worked on the voter registration effort, and one girl named Brenda Travis volunteered. On August 30th, they purchased tickets to New Orleans and sat at the whites-only lunch counter. They were charged with trespassing, jailed for almost a month, and Travis was expelled from school. In protest, more than 100 students staged a walkout of Berglund High School. Many were beaten by police and arrested. Without a trial, teenage Brenda Travis was sent to a juvenile detention center. Neither her mother nor her attorney were told where she was. All of this set the stage for what happened next. On November 29th, 1961, five black freedom riders from the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, attempt to integrate Macomb's segregated Greyhound bus station. The New York Times reports they were initially blocked at the door, but eventually get inside and sit down at the whites-only lunch counter. One of the men repeatedly asked for service, but was ignored. The operator of the bus terminal told them that the restaurant was privately owned and they had to get out. A white teenager grabbed a half-filled cup of coffee from a table, walked over to the black freedom rider who was trying to order, and struck him sharply on the base of the skull with the coffee cup. Other whites joined in, beating the freedom riders and pushing them out the door of the bus station into a mob of cursing white people, shouting, "Kill him! Kill him!" The Freedom Riders were mauled severely, but not seriously injured. They managed to escape their attackers, and later that night, Macomb police escorted them back to the bus station, and under the watchful eye of FBI agents, put them on a bus to New Orleans. While Aaron Henry was leading the Christmas boycott in the northwest corner of the state, and the FBI and U.S. Justice Department were investigating the attacks on the Freedom Riders in Macomb, Dr. Gilbert Mason Sr. was fighting to integrate the beaches along Mississippi's Gulf Coast. The beaches of Biloxi had been built in 1953 by the Army Corps of Engineers using taxpayer money. Nearby, white homeowners asserted they were private property and blacks weren't allowed. On May 14, 1959, Mason, a Howard University-educated physician, went to a local beach with some friends and their children. Police showed up and ordered them to leave. Mason and his friend went to the police station, demanding to know what law they'd broken. The police couldn't answer the question. When they returned the next day, Biloxi's mayor reportedly told them that if they went back to the beach, they'd be arrested. Mason helped organize a petition to allow unrestrained use of the beach. The Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission worked secretly to gather information on those who signed the petition, then pressured their employers to fire them. Several did. When Mason returned to the beach in April of 1960, he was arrested as a repeat offender. A week later in protest, more than 100 black men, women, and children gathered on the beach in what ended up being an event the New York Times described as the worst racial riot in Mississippi history. Biloxi police stood by as a white mob threw rocks and fired shots. The fighting lasted an entire weekend. 10 men, 2 white, 8 black, sustained gunshot wounds. People were seriously injured in fights. Gilbert Mason was arrested and convicted of disturbing the peace. A month later, the U.S. Justice Department sued Biloxi for denying African Americans access to federally funded beaches. The city repeatedly stalled the case. So in 1963, leaders of Biloxi's civil rights movement staged a third and final wade-in. Thousands of white residents showed up to the counter-protest. There was violence, but not as extreme as that in 1960. Police arrested 71 protesters, 68 of them black. It wasn't until 1968, almost a decade after Mason's first wade-in, that the entire 26-mile beachfront was open to all races. Coming up on the next episode, meet the champions of the fight for voting rights.
I could taste and smell reality. These white men, people I saw around town, who sometimes even smiled and spoke to me, were so consumed with hatred for me that one of them might actually kill me just to keep me from registering to vote.
After listening to the podcast, follow the actual Mississippi Freedom Trail that traces the entire state. Go to visitmississippi.org or civilrightstrail.com, where you can begin planning your trip. In this episode, we heard from historians Robert Luckett from Jackson State University and Daphne Chamberlain from Tougaloo College. We also heard from civil rights foot soldier and Jackson State University political scientist Leslie Burrell McLemore. He also served as interim mayor of the city of Jackson, as well as on the city council. And we heard from Sherita Johnson and Cheryl Jenkins of the Center for Black Studies at the University of Southern Mississippi. I'm Marlene Gordon. The Mississippi Freedom Trail podcast is sponsored by Visit Mississippi and the U.S. Civil Rights Trail Marketing Alliance. The series was produced by Ingredient Creative, with Tanner Latham as executive producer and Tanya Ott as writer and director. Jessica Martinitis was the producer. Elliot Majerzik edited and mixed the sound, and Catherine Welch was the researcher.